Random House Audiobooks presents The Universe in a Nutshell by Stephen Hawking. Read for you by Simon Preble. I hadn't expected my popular book, A Brief History of Time, to be such a success. It was on the London Sunday Times bestseller list for over 4 years, which is longer than any other book has been, and remarkable for a book on science that was not easygoing. After that, people kept asking when I would write a sequel. I resisted because I didn't want to write Son of Brief History or A Slightly Longer Brief History of Time, and because I was busy with research. But I've come to realize that there is room for a different kind of book that might be easier to understand. A Brief History of Time was organized in a linear fashion, with most chapters following and logically depending on the preceding chapters. This appealed to some readers, but others got stuck in the early chapters and never reached the more exciting material later on. By contrast, the present book is more like a tree. Chapters 1 and 2 form a central trunk from which the other chapters branch off. The branches are fairly independent of each other and can be tackled in any order after the central trunk. They correspond to areas I've worked on or thought about since the publication of A Brief History of Time. Thus, they present a picture of some of the most active fields of current research. Within each chapter, I've also tried to avoid a single linear structure. In 1988, when A Brief History of Time was first published, the ultimate theory of everything seemed to be just over the horizon. How has the situation changed since then? Are we any closer to our goal? As will be described in this book, we have advanced a long way since then. But it's an ongoing journey still, and the end is not yet in sight. According to the old saying, it is better to travel hopefully than to arrive. Our quest for discovery fuels our creativity in all fields, not just science. If we reached the end of the line, the human spirit would shrivel and die. But I don't think we'll ever stand still. We shall increase in complexity, if not in depth, and shall always be the center of an expanding horizon of possibilities. I want to share my excitement at the discoveries that are being made and the picture of reality that is emerging. I've concentrated on areas I've worked on myself for a greater feeling of immediacy. The details of the work are very technical, but I believe the broad ideas can be conveyed without a lot of mathematical baggage. I just hope I've succeeded. I've had a lot of help with this book. I would mention in particular Thomas Hertog and Neil Shearer for assistance with the figures, captions and boxes. Anne Harris and Kitty Ferguson, who edited the manuscript, or more accurately, the computer files, because everything I write is electronic. And Philip Dunn of the Book Laboratory and Moonrunner Design, who created the illustrations. But beyond that, I want to thank all those who have made it possible for me to lead a fairly normal life and carry on scientific research. Without them, this book could not have been written. Stephen Hawking, Cambridge, May the 2nd, 2001. Chapter 1. A Brief History of Relativity. How Einstein laid the foundations of the two fundamental theories of the 20th century, general relativity and quantum theory. Albert Einstein, the discoverer of the special and general theories of relativity, was born in Ulm, Germany, in 1879. But the following year, the family moved to Munich, where his father, Hermann, and uncle Jakob set up a small and not very successful electrical business. Albert was no child prodigy, but claims that he did poorly at school seem to be an exaggeration. In 1894, his father's business failed, and the family moved to Milan. His parents decided he should stay behind to finish school, but he didn't like its authoritarianism, and within months he left to join his family in Italy. He later completed his education in Zurich, graduating from the prestigious Federal Polytechnical School, known as the ETH, in 1900. His argumentative nature and dislike of authority did not endear him to the professors at the ETH, and none of them offered him the position of assistant, which was the normal route to an academic career. 2 years later, he finally managed to get a junior post at the Swiss Patent Office in Bern. It was while he held this job that in 1905 he wrote three papers that both established him as one of the world's leading scientists and started two conceptual revolutions. Revolutions that changed our understanding of time, space, and reality itself. Toward the end of the 19th century, scientists believed they were close to a complete description of the universe. They imagined that space was filled by a continuous medium called the ether. Light rays and radio signals were waves in this ether, just as sound is pressure waves in air. All that was needed for a complete theory were careful measurements of the elastic properties of the ether. In fact, anticipating such measurements, the Jefferson Lab at Harvard University was built entirely without iron nails, so as not to interfere with delicate magnetic measurements. However, the planners forgot that the reddish-brown bricks of which the lab and most of Harvard are built contain large amounts of iron. The building is still in use today, although Harvard is still not sure how much weight a library floor without iron nails will support. By the century's end, discrepancies in the idea of an all-pervading ether began to appear. It was expected that light would travel at a fixed speed through the ether, but that if you were travelling through the ether in the same direction as the light, its speed would appear lower, and if you were travelling in the opposite direction of the light, its speed would appear higher. Yet, a series of experiments failed to support this idea. The most careful and accurate of these experiments was carried out by Albert Michelson and Edward Morley at the Case School of Applied Science in Cleveland, Ohio, in 1887. They compared the speed of light in two beams at right angles to each other. As the Earth rotates on its axis and orbits the Sun, the apparatus moves through the ether with varying speed and direction. But Michelson and Morley found no daily or yearly differences between the two beams of light. It was as if light always travelled at the same speed relative to where one was, no matter how fast and in which direction one was moving. Based on the Michelson-Morley experiment, the Irish physicist George Fitzgerald and the Dutch physicist Hendrik Lorentz suggested that bodies moving through the ether would contract and that clocks would slow down. This contraction and the slowing down of clocks would be such that people would all measure the same speed for light, no matter how they were moving with respect to the ether. Fitzgerald and Lorentz still regarded ether as a real substance. However, in a paper written in June 1905, Einstein pointed out that if one could not detect whether or not one was moving through space, the notion of an ether was redundant. Instead, he started from the postulate that the laws of science should appear the same to all freely moving observers. In particular, they should all measure the same speed for light, no matter how fast they were moving. The speed of light is independent of their motion and is the same in all directions. This required abandoning the idea that there is a universal quantity called time that all clocks would measure. Instead, everyone would have his or her own personal time. The times of two people would agree if the people were at rest with respect to each other, but not if they were moving. This has been confirmed by a number of experiments, including one in which two accurate clocks were flown in opposite directions around the world and returned showing very slightly different times. This might suggest that if one wanted to live longer, one should keep flying to the east so that the plane's speed is added to the Earth's rotation. However, the tiny fraction of a second one would gain would be more than cancelled by eating airline meals. The Twins' Paradox. In the theory of relativity, each observer has their own measure of time. This can lead to the so-called Twins' Paradox. One of a pair of twins leaves on a space journey during which he travels close to the speed of light, while his brother remains on Earth. Because of his motion, time runs more slowly in the spacecraft as seen by the Earthbound twin. So on his return, the space traveller will find that his brother has aged more than himself. Although it seems against common sense, a number of experiments have implied that in this scenario, the travelling twin would indeed be younger. A spaceship passes Earth from left to right at 4/5 the speed of light. A pulse of light is emitted at one end of the cabin and reflected at the other end. The light is observed by people on Earth and on the spaceship. Because of the motion of the spaceship, they will disagree about the distance the light has travelled in reflecting back. They must, therefore, also disagree about the time the light has taken, according to Einstein's postulate that the speed of light is the same for all freely moving observers. Einstein's postulate that the laws of nature should appear the same to all freely moving observers was the foundation of the theory of relativity, so called because it implied that only relative motion was important. Its beauty and simplicity convinced many thinkers, but there remained a lot of opposition. Einstein had overthrown two of the absolutes of 19th century science: absolute rest, as represented by the ether, and absolute or universal time, which all clocks would measure. Many people found this an unsettling concept. Did it imply, they asked, that everything was relative? That there were no absolute moral standards? This unease continued throughout the 1920s and 1930s. When Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1921, the citation was for important but, by his standard, comparatively minor work also carried out in 1905. It made no mention of relativity, which was considered too controversial. I still get two or three letters a week telling me Einstein was wrong. Nevertheless, the theory of relativity is now completely accepted by the scientific community, and its predictions have been verified in countless applications. A very important consequence of relativity is the relation between mass and energy. Einstein's postulate that the speed of light should appear the same to everyone implied that nothing could be moving faster than light. What happens is that as one uses energy to accelerate anything, whether a particle or a spaceship, its mass increases, making it harder to accelerate it further. To accelerate a particle to the speed of light would be impossible, because it would take an infinite amount of energy. Mass and energy are equivalent, as is summed up in Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared. This is probably the only equation in physics to have recognition on the street. Among its consequences was the realization that if the nucleus of a uranium atom fissions into two nuclei with slightly less total mass, this will release a tremendous amount of energy. In 1939, as the prospect of another world war loomed, a group of scientists who realized these implications persuaded Einstein to overcome his pacifist scruples and add his authority to a letter to President Roosevelt, urging the United States to start a program of nuclear research. This led to the Manhattan Project, and ultimately to the bombs that exploded over Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Some people have blamed the atom bomb on Einstein, because he discovered the relationship between mass and energy. But that's like blaming Newton for causing airplanes to crash, because he discovered gravity. Einstein himself took no part in the Manhattan Project and was horrified by the dropping of the bomb. Einstein's prophetic letter to President Roosevelt in 1939. In the course of the last 4 months, it has been made probable, through the work of Joliot in France, as well as Fermi and Szilard in America, that it may become possible to set up a nuclear chain reaction in a large mass of uranium, by which vast amounts of power and large quantities of new radium-like elements would be generated. Now it appears almost certain that this could be achieved in the immediate future. This new phenomenon would also lead to the construction of bombs, and it is conceivable, though much less certain, that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. After his groundbreaking papers in 1905, Einstein's scientific reputation was established, but it was not until 1909 that he was offered a position at the University of Zurich that enabled him to leave the Swiss Patent Office. 2 years later, he moved to the German University in Prague, but he came back to Zurich in 1912, this time to the ETH. Despite the anti-Semitism that was common in much of Europe, even in the universities, he was now an academic hot property. Offers came in from Vienna and Utrecht, but he chose to accept a research position with the Prussian Academy of Sciences in Berlin, because it freed him from teaching duties. He moved to Berlin in April 1914 and was joined shortly after by his wife and two sons. The marriage had been in a bad way for some time, however, and his family soon returned to Zurich. Although he visited them occasionally, he and his wife were eventually divorced. Einstein later married his cousin Elsa, who lived in Berlin. The fact that he spent the war years as a bachelor, without domestic commitments, may be one reason why this period was so productive for him scientifically. Although the theory of relativity fitted well with the laws that governed electricity and magnetism, it was not compatible with Newton's law of gravity. This law said that if one changed the distribution of matter in one region of space, the change in the gravitational field would be felt instantaneously everywhere else in the universe. Not only would this mean one could send signals faster than light, something that was forbidden by relativity, in order to know what instantaneous meant, it also required the existence of absolute or universal time, which relativity had abolished in favor of personal time. Einstein was aware of this difficulty in 1907 while he was still at the patent office in Bern, but it was not until he was in Prague in 1911 that he began to think seriously about the problem. He realized that there's a close relationship between acceleration and a gravitational field. Someone inside a closed box, such as an elevator, could not tell whether the box was at rest in the Earth's gravitational field or was being accelerated by a rocket in free space. Of course, this was before the age of Star Trek, and so Einstein thought of people in elevators rather than spaceships. But one cannot accelerate or fall freely very far in an elevator before disaster strikes. If the Earth were flat, one could equally well say that the apple fell on Newton's head because of gravity, or because Newton and the surface of the Earth were accelerating upward. This equivalence between acceleration and gravity didn't seem to work for a round Earth, however. People on the opposite sides of the world would have to be accelerating in opposite directions, but staying at a constant distance from each other. But on his return to Zurich in 1912, Einstein had the brainwave of realizing that the equivalence would work if the geometry of space-time was curved and not flat, as had been assumed hitherto. His idea was that mass and energy would warp space-time in some manner yet to be determined. Objects such as apples or planets would try to move in straight lines through space-time, but their paths would appear to be bent by a gravitational field because space-time is curved. With the help of his friend Marcel Grossmann, Einstein studied the theory of curved spaces and surfaces that had been developed earlier by George Friedrich Riemann as a piece of abstract mathematics. Riemann had had no thought that it would be relevant to the real world. Einstein and Grossmann wrote a joint paper in 1913 in which they put forward the idea that what we think of as gravitational forces are just an expression of the fact that space-time is curved. However, because of a mistake by Einstein, who was quite human and fallible, they weren't able to find the equations that related the curvature of space-time to the mass and energy in it. Einstein continued to work on the problem in Berlin, undisturbed by domestic matters and largely unaffected by the war, until he finally found the right equations in November 1915. He had discussed his ideas with the mathematician David Hilbert during a visit to the University of Göttingen in the summer of 1915, and Hilbert independently found the same equations a few days before Einstein. Nevertheless, as Hilbert himself admitted, the credit for the new theory belonged to Einstein. It was his idea to relate gravity to the warping of space-time. It's a tribute to the civilized state of Germany at this period that such scientific discussions and exchanges could go on undisturbed even in wartime. It was a sharp contrast to the Nazis 20 years later. The new theory of curved space-time was called general relativity, to distinguish it from the original theory without gravity, which was now known as special relativity. It was confirmed in a spectacular fashion in 1919, when a British expedition to West Africa observed a slight bending of light passing near the sun during an eclipse. Here was direct evidence that space and time are warped, and it spurred the greatest change in our perception of the universe in which we live since Euclid wrote his Elements of Geometry around 300 BC. Einstein's general theory of relativity transformed space and time from a passive background in which events take place to active participants in the dynamics of the universe. This led to a great problem that remains at the forefront of physics in the 21st century. The universe is full of matter, and matter warps space-time in such a way that bodies fall together. Einstein found that his equations didn't have a solution that described a static universe unchanging in time. Rather than give up such an everlasting universe, which he and most other people believed in, he fudged the equations by adding a term called the cosmological constant, which warps space-time in the opposite sense, so that bodies move apart. The repulsive effect of the cosmological constant could balance the attractive effect of the matter, thus allowing a static solution for the universe. This was one of the great missed opportunities of theoretical physics. If Einstein had stuck with his original equations, he could have predicted that the universe must be either expanding or contracting. As it was, the possibility of a time-dependent universe wasn't taken seriously until observations in the 1920s by the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson. These observations revealed that the farther other galaxies are from us, the faster they're moving away. The universe is expanding, with the distance between any two galaxies steadily increasing with time. This discovery removed the need for a cosmological constant in order to have a static solution for the universe. Einstein later called the cosmological constant the greatest mistake of his life. However, it now seems that it may not have been a mistake after all. Recent observations, described in Chapter 3, suggest that there may indeed be a small cosmological constant. General relativity completely changed the discussion of the origin and fate of the universe. A static universe could have existed forever or could have been created in its present form at some time in the past. However, if galaxies are moving apart now, it means that they must have been closer together in the past. About 15 billion years ago, they would all have been on top of each other, and the density would have been very large. This state was called the primeval atom by the Catholic priest Georges Lemaître, who was the first to investigate the origin of the universe that we now call the Big Bang. Einstein seems never to have taken the Big Bang seriously. He apparently thought that the simple model of a uniformly expanding universe would break down if one followed the motions of the galaxies back in time, and that the small sideways velocities of the galaxies would cause them to miss each other. He thought the universe might have had a previous contracting phase, with a bounce into the present expansion at a fairly moderate density. However, we now know that in order for nuclear reactions in the early universe to produce the amounts of light elements we observe around us, the density must have been at least 10 tons per cubic inch, and the temperature 10 billion degrees. Further observations of the microwave background indicate that the density was probably once a trillion, 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 one with 72 zeros after it, tons per cubic inch. We also now know that Einstein's general theory of relativity does not allow the universe to bounce from a contracting phase to the present expansion. As will be discussed in Chapter 2, Roger Penrose and I were able to show that general relativity predicts that the universe began in the Big Bang. So Einstein's theory does imply that time has a beginning, although he was never happy with the idea. Einstein was even more reluctant to admit that general relativity predicted that time would come to an end for massive stars when they reached the end of their life and no longer generated enough heat to balance the force of their own gravity, which was trying to make them smaller. Einstein thought that such stars would settle down to some final state, but we now know that there are no final state configurations for stars of more than twice the mass of the Sun. Such stars will continue to shrink until they become black holes, regions of space-time that are so warped that light cannot escape from them. When a massive star exhausts its nuclear fuel, it will lose heat and contract. The warping of space-time will become so great that a black hole will be created, from which light cannot escape. Inside the black hole, time will come to an end. Penrose and I showed that general relativity predicted that time would come to an end inside a black hole, both for the star and for any unfortunate astronaut who happened to fall into it. But both the beginning and the end of time would be places where the equations of general relativity could not be defined. Thus, the theory could not predict what should emerge from the Big Bang. Some saw this as an indication of God's freedom to start the universe off in any way God wanted. But others, including myself, felt that the beginning of the universe should be governed by the same laws that held at other times. We've made some progress toward this goal, as will be described in Chapter 3, but we don't yet have a complete understanding of the origin of the universe. The reason general relativity broke down at the Big Bang was that it was not compatible with quantum theory, the other great conceptual revolution of the early 20th century. The first step toward quantum theory had come in 1900, when Max Planck in Berlin discovered that the radiation from a body that was glowing red hot was explainable if light could be emitted or absorbed, only if it came in discrete packets called quanta. In one of his groundbreaking papers, written in 1905, when he was at the patent office, Einstein showed that Planck's quantum hypothesis could explain what is called the photoelectric effect, the way certain metals give off electrons when light falls on them. This is the basis of modern light detectors and television cameras, and it was for this work that Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics. Einstein continued to work on the quantum idea into the 1920s, but he was deeply disturbed by the work of Werner Heisenberg in Copenhagen, Paul Dirac in Cambridge, and Erwin Schrödinger in Zurich, who developed a new picture of reality called quantum mechanics. No longer did tiny particles have a definite position and speed. Instead, the more accurately one determined a particle's position, the less accurately one could determine its speed, and vice versa. Einstein was horrified by this random, unpredictable element in the basic laws, and never fully accepted quantum mechanics. His feelings were expressed in his famous dictum, "God does not play dice." Most other scientists, however, accepted the validity of the new quantum laws because of the explanations they gave for a whole range of previously unaccounted for phenomena and their excellent agreement with observations. They are the basis of modern developments in chemistry, molecular biology, and electronics, and the foundation for the technology that has transformed the world in the last 50 years. In December 1932, aware that the Nazis and Hitler were about to come to power, Einstein left Germany and 4 months later renounced his citizenship, spending the last 20 years of his life at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. In Germany, the Nazis launched a campaign against Jewish science and the many German scientists who were Jews. This is part of the reason that Germany was not able to build an atomic bomb. Einstein and relativity were principal targets of this campaign. When told of the publication of a book entitled 100 Authors Against Einstein, he replied, "Why 100? If I were wrong, one would have been enough." After the Second World War, he urged the Allies to set up a world government to control the atomic bomb. In 1948, he was offered the presidency of the new state of Israel, but turned it down. He once said, "Politics is for the moment, but an equation is for eternity." The Einstein equations of general relativity are his best epitaph and memorial. They should last as long as the universe. The world has changed far more in the last 100 years than in any previous century. The reason has not been new political or economic doctrines, but the vast developments in technology made possible by advances in basic science. Who better symbolizes those advances than Albert Einstein? Chapter 2. The Shape of Time. Einstein's general relativity gives time a shape. How this can be reconciled with quantum theory. What is time? Is it an ever-rolling stream that bears all our dreams away, as the old hymn says? Or is it a railroad track? Maybe it has loops and branches, so you can keep going forward and yet return to an earlier station on the line. The 19th century author Charles Lamb wrote, "Nothing puzzles me like time and space, and yet nothing troubles me less than time and space, because I never think of them." Most of us don't worry about time and space most of the time, whatever that may be. But we all do wonder sometimes what time is, how it began, and where it is leading us. Any sound scientific theory, whether of time or of any other concept, should, in my opinion, be based on the most workable philosophy of science, the positivist approach put forward by Karl Popper and others. According to this way of thinking, a scientific theory is a mathematical model that describes and codifies the observations we make. A good theory will describe a large range of phenomena on the basis of a few simple postulates, and will make definite predictions that can be tested. If the predictions agree with the observations, the theory survives that test, though it can never be proved to be correct. On the other hand, if the observations disagree with the predictions, one has to discard or modify the theory. At least, that is what is supposed to happen. In practice, people often question the accuracy of the observations, and the reliability and moral character of those making the observations. If one takes the positivist position, as I do, one cannot say what time actually is. All one can do is describe what has been found to be a very good mathematical model for time and say what predictions it makes. Isaac Newton gave us the first mathematical model for time and space in his Principia Mathematica, published in 1687. Newton occupied the Lucasian chair at Cambridge that I now hold, though it wasn't electrically operated in his time. In Newton's model, time and space were a background in which events took place, but which wasn't affected by them. Time was separate from space, and was considered to be a single line or railroad track that was infinite in both directions. Time itself was considered eternal, in the sense that it had existed and would exist forever. By contrast, most people thought the physical universe had been created more or less in its present state only a few thousand years ago. This worried philosophers such as the German thinker Immanuel Kant. If the universe had indeed been created, why had there been an infinite wait before the creation? On the other hand, if the universe had existed forever, why hadn't everything that was going to happen already happened, meaning that history was over? In particular, why hadn't the universe reached thermal equilibrium with everything at the same temperature? Kant called this problem an antinomy of pure reason, because it seemed to be a logical contradiction. It didn't have a resolution. But it was a contradiction only within the context of the Newtonian mathematical model, in which time was an infinite line, independent of what was happening in the universe. However, as we saw in Chapter 1, in 1915, a completely new mathematical model was put forward by Einstein, the general theory of relativity. In the years since Einstein's paper, we've added a few ribbons and bows, but our model of time and space is still based on what Einstein proposed. This and the following chapters will describe how our ideas have developed in the years since Einstein's revolutionary paper. It has been a success story of the work of a large number of people, and I'm proud to have made a small contribution. General relativity combines the time dimension with the three dimensions of space to form what is called space-time. The theory incorporates the effect of gravity by saying that the distribution of matter and energy in the universe warps and distorts space-time so that it's not flat. Objects in this space-time try to move in straight lines, but because space-time is curved, their paths appear bent. They move as if affected by a gravitational field. As a rough analogy, not to be taken too literally, imagine a sheet of rubber. One can place a large ball on the sheet to represent the sun. The weight of the ball will depress the sheet and cause it to be curved near the sun. If one now rolls little ball bearings on the sheet, they won't roll straight across to the other side, but instead will go around the heavy weight, like planets orbiting the sun. The analogy is incomplete because in it only a two-dimensional section of space, the surface of the rubber sheet, is curved, and time is left undisturbed, as it is in Newtonian theory. However, in the theory of relativity, which agrees with a large number of experiments, time and space are inextricably tangled up. One cannot curve space without involving time as well. Thus, time has a shape. By curving space and time, general relativity changes them from being a passive background against which events take place to being active dynamic participants in what happens. In Newtonian theory, where time existed independently of anything else, one could ask, what did God do before he created the universe? As St. Augustine said, one should not joke about this, as did a man who said he was preparing hell for those who pry too deep. It is a serious question that people have pondered down the ages. According to St. Augustine, before God made heaven and earth, he didn't make anything at all. In fact, this is very close to modern ideas. On the other hand, in general relativity, time and space do not exist independently of the universe or of each other. They're defined by measurements within the universe, such as the number of vibrations of a quartz crystal in a clock, or the length of a ruler. It is quite conceivable that time defined in this way within the universe should have a minimum or maximum value. In other words, a beginning or an end. It would make no sense to ask what happened before the beginning or after the end, because such times would not be defined. It was clearly important to decide whether the mathematical model of general relativity predicted that the universe and time itself should have a beginning or end. The general prejudice among theoretical physicists, including Einstein, held that time should be infinite in both directions. Otherwise, there were awkward questions about the creation of the universe, which seemed to be outside the realm of science. Solutions of the Einstein equations were known in which time had a beginning or end, but these were all very special, with a large amount of symmetry. It was thought that in a real body, collapsing under its own gravity, pressure or sideways velocities would prevent all the matter falling together to the same point, where the density would be infinite. Similarly, if one traced the expansion of the universe back in time, one would find that the matter of the universe didn't all emerge from a point of infinite density. Such a point of infinite density was called a singularity, and would be a beginning or an end of time. In 1963, two Russian scientists, Yevgeny Lifshitz and Isaac Kolakonikov, claimed to have proved that solutions of the Einstein equations with a singularity all had a special arrangement of matter and velocities. The chances that the solution representing the universe would have this special arrangement were practically zero. Almost all solutions that could represent the universe would avoid having a singularity of infinite density. Before the era during which the universe has been expanding, there must have been a previous contracting phase, during which matter fell together but missed colliding with itself, moving apart again in the present expanding phase. If this were the case, time would continue on forever, from the infinite past to the infinite future. Not everyone was convinced by the arguments of Lifshitz and Kolakonikov. Instead, Roger Penrose and I adopted a different approach, based not on a detailed study of solutions, but on the global structure of space-time. In general relativity, space-time is curved not only by massive objects in it, but also by the energy in it. Energy is always positive, so it gives space-time a curvature that bends the paths of light rays toward each other. Now, consider our past light cone, that is, the paths through space-time of the light rays from distant galaxies that reach us at the present time. In a diagram, with time plotted upward and space plotted sideways, this is a cone with its vertex, or point, at us. As we go toward the past, down the cone from the vertex, we see galaxies at earlier and earlier times. Because the universe has been expanding, and everything used to be much closer together, as we look back further, we're looking back through regions of higher matter density. We observe a faint background of microwave radiation that propagates to us along our past light cone from a much earlier time, when the universe was much denser and hotter than it is now. By tuning receivers to different frequencies of microwaves, we can measure the spectrum, the distribution of power arranged by frequency, of this radiation. We find a spectrum that is characteristic of radiation from a body at a temperature of 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. This microwave radiation is not much good for defrosting frozen pizza, But the fact that the spectrum agrees so exactly with that of radiation from a body at 2.7 degrees tells us that the radiation must have come from regions that are opaque to microwaves. Thus, we can conclude that our past light cone must pass through a certain amount of matter as one follows it back. This amount of matter is enough to curve space-time, so that the light rays in our past light cone are bent back toward each other. As one goes back in time, the cross-sections of our past light cone reach a maximum size and begin to get smaller again. Our past is pear-shaped. As one follows our past light cone back still further, the positive energy density of matter causes the light rays to bend toward each other more strongly. The cross-section of the light cone will shrink to zero size in a finite time. This means that all the matter inside our past light cone is trapped in a region whose boundary shrinks to zero. It's therefore not very surprising that Penrose and I could prove that in the mathematical model of general relativity, time must have a beginning in what is called the Big Bang. Similar arguments show that time would have an end when stars or galaxies collapse under their own gravity to form black holes. We had sidestepped Kant's antimony of pure reason by dropping his implicit assumption that time had a meaning independent of the universe. Our paper, proving time had a beginning, won the second prize in the competition sponsored by the Gravity Research Foundation in 1968, and Roger and I shared the princely sum of $300. I don't think the other prize essays of that year have shown much enduring value. There were various reactions to our work. It upset many physicists, but it delighted those religious leaders who believed in an act of creation, for here was scientific proof. Meanwhile, Lifshitz and Kolatnikov were in an awkward position. They couldn't argue with the mathematical theorems that we'd proved, but under the Soviet system, they couldn't admit that they'd been wrong and Western science had been right. However, they saved the situation by finding a more general family of solutions with a singularity, which weren't special in the way their previous solutions had been. This enabled them to claim singularities and the beginning or end of time as a Soviet discovery. Most physicists still instinctively dislike the idea of time having a beginning or end. They therefore pointed out that the mathematical model might be expected not to be a good description of space-time near a singularity. The reason is that general relativity, which describes the gravitational force, is a classical theory, as noted in Chapter 1, and does not incorporate the uncertainty of quantum theory that governs all other forces we know. This inconsistency doesn't matter in most of the universe most of the time, because the scale on which space-time is curved is very large, and the scale on which quantum effects are important is very small. But near a singularity, the two scales would be comparable, and quantum gravitational effects would be important. So what the singularity theorems of Penrose and myself really established is that our classical region of space-time is bounded to the past, and possibly to the future, by regions in which quantum gravity is important. To understand the origin and fate of the universe, we need a quantum theory of gravity, and this will be the subject of most of this book. An important step in the discovery of quantum theory was Max Planck's suggestion in 1900 that light always comes in little packets he called quanta. But while Planck's quantum hypothesis clearly explained observations of the rate of radiation from hot bodies, the full extent of its implications wasn't realized until the mid-1920s, when the German physicist, Werner Heisenberg, formulated his famous uncertainty principle. He noted that Planck's hypothesis implies that the more accurately one tries to measure the position of a particle, the less accurately one can measure its speed, and vice versa. More precisely, he showed that the uncertainty in the position of a particle times the uncertainty in its momentum must always be larger than Planck's constant, which is a quantity that's closely related to the energy content of one quantum of light. The Maxwell field. In 1865, the British physicist James Clerk Maxwell combined all the known laws of electricity and magnetism. Maxwell's theory rests on the existence of fields that transmit actions from one place to another. He recognized that the fields that transmit electric and magnetic disturbances are dynamical entities. They can oscillate and move through space. Maxwell's synthesis of electromagnetism can be condensed into two equations that prescribe the dynamics of these fields. He himself derived the first great conclusion from these equations, that electromagnetic waves of all frequencies travel through space at the same fixed speed, the speed of light. Quantum theories of systems such as atoms with a finite number of particles were formulated in the 1920s by Heisenberg, Schrödinger, and Dirac. Dirac was another previous holder of my chair in Cambridge, but it still wasn't motorized. However, people encountered difficulties when they tried to extend quantum ideas to the Maxwell field, which describes electricity, magnetism, and light. The Maxwell field. In 1865, the British physicist James Clerk Maxwell combined all the known laws of electricity and magnetism. Maxwell's theory rests on the existence of fields that transmit actions from one place to another. He recognized that the fields that transmit electric and magnetic disturbances are dynamical entities. They can oscillate and move through space. Maxwell's synthesis of electromagnetism can be condensed into two equations that prescribe the dynamics of these fields. He himself derived the first great conclusion from these equations, that electromagnetic waves of all frequencies travel through space at the same fixed speed, the speed of light. One can think of the Maxwell field as being made up of waves of different wavelengths, the distance between one wave crest and the next. In a wave, the field will swing from one value to another like a pendulum. According to quantum theory, the ground state, or lowest energy state of a pendulum, is not just sitting at the lowest energy point, pointing straight down. That would have both a definite position and a definite velocity, zero. This would be a violation of the uncertainty principle, which forbids the precise measurement of both position and velocity at the same time. The uncertainty in the position, multiplied by the uncertainty in the momentum, must be greater than a certain quantity, known as Planck's constant, a number that's too long to keep writing down, so we use a symbol for it. So, the ground state, or lowest energy state of a pendulum, does not have zero energy, as one might expect. Instead, even in its ground state, a pendulum or any oscillating system must have a certain minimum amount of what are called zero-point fluctuations. These mean that the pendulum won't necessarily be pointing straight down, but will also have a probability of being found at a small angle to the vertical. Similarly, even in the vacuum or lowest energy state, the waves in the Maxwell field won't be exactly zero, but can have small sizes. The higher the frequency, the number of swings per minute of the pendulum or wave, the higher the energy of the ground state. Calculations of the ground state fluctuations in the Maxwell and electron fields made the apparent mass and charge of the electron infinite, which is not what observations show. However, in the 1940s, the physicists Richard Feynman, Julian Schwinger, and Shinichiro Tomonaga developed a consistent way of removing or subtracting out these infinities and dealing only with the finite observed values of the mass and charge. Nevertheless, the ground state fluctuations still caused small effects that could be measured, and that agreed well with experiment. Similar subtraction schemes for removing infinities worked for the Yang-Mills field in the theory put forward by Chen-Ning Yang and Robert Mills. Yang-Mills theory is an extension of Maxwell theory that describes interactions in two other forces called the weak and strong nuclear forces. However, ground state fluctuations have a much more serious effect in a quantum theory of gravity. Again, each wavelength would have a ground state energy. Since there is no limit to how short the wavelength of the Maxwell field can be, there are an infinite number of different wavelengths in any region of space-time, and an infinite amount of ground state energy. Because energy density is, like matter, a source of gravity, this infinite energy density ought to mean there is enough gravitational attraction in the universe to curl space-time into a single point, which obviously hasn't happened. One might hope to solve the problem of this seeming contradiction between observation and theory by saying that the ground state fluctuations have no gravitational effect. But this wouldn't work. One can detect the energy of ground state fluctuations by the Casimir effect. If you place a pair of metal plates parallel to each other and close together, the effect of the plates is to reduce slightly the number of wavelengths that fit between the plates relative to the number outside. This means that the energy density of ground state fluctuations between the plates, although still infinite, is less than the energy density outside by a finite amount. This difference in energy density gives rise to a force pulling the plates together, and this force has been observed experimentally. Forces are a source of gravity in general relativity, just as matter is, so it would not be consistent to ignore the gravitational effect of this energy difference. Another possible solution to the problem might be to suppose there was a cosmological constant, such as Einstein introduced, in an attempt to have a static model of the universe. If this constant had an infinite negative value, it could exactly cancel the infinite positive value of the ground state energies in free space. But this cosmological constant seems very ad hoc, and it would have to be tuned to extraordinary accuracy. Fortunately, a totally new kind of symmetry was discovered in the 1970s that provides a natural physical mechanism to cancel the infinities arising from ground state fluctuations. Supersymmetry is a feature of our modern mathematical models that can be described in various ways. One way is to say that space-time has extra dimensions, besides the dimensions we experience. These are called Grassmann dimensions because they're measured in numbers known as Grassmann variables rather than in ordinary real numbers. Ordinary numbers commute, that is, it doesn't matter in which order you multiply them. 6 times 4 is the same as 4 times 6. But Grassmann variables anti-commute. X times Y is the same as negative Y times X. Supersymmetry was first considered for removing infinities in matter fields and Yang-Mills fields in a space-time where both the ordinary number dimensions and the Grassmann dimensions were flat, not curved. But it was natural to extend it to ordinary numbers and Grassmann dimensions that were curved. This led to a number of theories called supergravity, with different amounts of supersymmetry. One consequence of supersymmetry is that every field or particle should have a superpartner with a spin that is either one-half greater than its own or one-half less. Spin of particle. All particles have a property called spin, having to do with what the particle looks like from different directions. One can illustrate this with a pack of playing cards. Consider first the Ace of Spades. This looks the same only if you turn it through a complete revolution, or 360 degrees. It is therefore said to have spin one. On the other hand, the Queen of Hearts has two heads. It is therefore the same under only half a revolution, 180 degrees. It is said to have spin two. Similarly, one could imagine objects with spin 3 or higher that would look the same under smaller fractions of a revolution. The higher the spin, the smaller the fraction of a complete revolution necessary to have the particle look the same. But the remarkable fact is that there are particles that look the same only if you turn them through two complete revolutions. Such particles are said to have spin 1/2. The ground state energies of bosons, fields whose spin is a whole number, 0, 1, 2, etc., are positive. On the other hand, the ground state energies of fermions, fields whose spin is a half number, 1/2, 3/2, etc., are negative. Because there are equal numbers of bosons and fermions, the biggest infinities cancel in supergravity theories. Superpartners. All known particles in the universe belong to one of two groups, fermions or bosons. Fermions are particles with half-integer spin, such as spin 1/2, and they make up ordinary matter. Their ground state energies are negative. Bosons are particles with integer spin, such as 0, 1, 2, and these give rise to forces between the fermions, such as the gravitational force and light. Their ground state energies are positive. Supergravity theory supposes that every fermion and every boson has a superpartner with a spin that is either one-half greater than its own or one-half less. For example, a photon, which is a boson, has a spin of 1. Its ground state energy is positive. The photon's superpartner, the photino, has a spin of 1/2, making it a fermion. Hence, its ground state energy is negative. In this supergravity scheme, we end up with equal numbers of bosons and fermions, with the ground state energies of the bosons weighing in on the positive side and the fermions weighing in on the negative side. The ground state energies cancel one another out, eliminating the biggest infinities. There remained the possibility that there might be smaller but still infinite quantities left over. No one had the patience needed to calculate whether these theories were actually completely finite. It was reckoned it would take a good student 200 years, and how would you know he hadn't made a mistake on the second page? Still, up to 1985, most people believed that most supersymmetric supergravity theories would be free of infinities. Then suddenly, the fashion changed. People declared there was no reason not to expect infinities in supergravity theories, and this was taken to mean they were fatally flawed as theories. Instead, it was claimed that a theory named supersymmetric string theory was the only way to combine gravity with quantum theory. Strings, like their namesakes in everyday experience, are one-dimensional, extended objects. They have only length. Strings in string theory move through a background space-time. Ripples on the string are interpreted as particles. String oscillations. In string theory, the basic objects are not particles, which occupy a single point in space, but one-dimensional strings. These strings may have ends, or they may join up with themselves in closed loops. Just like the strings on a violin, the strings in string theory support certain resonant vibrational patterns, or resonant frequencies, whose wavelengths fit precisely between the two ends. But while the different resonant frequencies of a violin's strings give rise to different musical notes, the different oscillations of a string give rise to different masses and force charges, which are interpreted as fundamental particles. Roughly speaking, the shorter the wavelength of the oscillation on the string, the greater the mass of the particle. If the strings have Grassmann dimensions, as well as their ordinary number dimensions, the ripples will correspond to bosons and fermions. In this case, the positive and negative ground state energies will cancel so exactly that there will be no infinities even of the smaller sort. Superstrings, it was claimed, were the TOE, the theory of everything. Historians of science in the future will find it interesting to chart the changing tide of opinion among theoretical physicists. For a few years, strings reigned supreme, and supergravity was dismissed as just an approximate theory valid at low energy. The qualification, low energy, was considered particularly damning, even though in this context, low energies meant particles with energies of less than a billion billion times those of particles in a TNT explosion. If supergravity was only a low-energy approximation, it could not claim to be the fundamental theory of the universe. Instead, the underlying theory was supposed to be one of five possible superstring theories. But which of the five string theories described our universe? And how could string theory be formulated beyond the approximation in which strings were pictured as surfaces with one space dimension and one time dimension moving through a flat background space-time? Wouldn't the strings curve the background space-time? In the years after 1985, it gradually became apparent that string theory wasn't the complete picture. To start with, it was realized that strings are just one member of a wide class of objects that can be extended in more than one dimension. Paul Townsend, who, like me, is a member of the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge, and who did much of the fundamental work on these objects, gave them the name P-brains. That's P-B-R-A-N-E-S. A P-brain has length in P directions. Thus, a P equals one brain is a string. A P equals two brain is a surface or membrane, and so on. There seems to be no reason to favour the P equals one string case over other possible values of P. Instead, we should adopt the principle of P-brain democracy. All P-brains are created equal. All the P-brains could be found as solutions of the equations of supergravity theories in 10 or 11 dimensions. While 10 or 11 dimensions doesn't sound much like the space-time we experience, the idea was that the other 6 or 7 dimensions are curled up so small that we don't notice them. We're only aware of the remaining 4 large and nearly flat dimensions. I must say that personally, I've been reluctant to believe in extra dimensions. But as I'm a positivist, the question, do extra dimensions really exist, has no meaning. All one can ask is whether mathematical models with extra dimensions provide a good description of the universe. We don't yet have any observations that require extra dimensions for their explanation. However, there is a possibility we may observe them in the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. But what has convinced many people, including myself, that one should take models with extra dimensions seriously is that there is a web of unexpected relationships called dualities between the models. These dualities show that the models are all essentially equivalent. That is, they are just different aspects of the same underlying theory, which has been given the name M-theory. Not to take this web of dualities as a sign we're on the right track would be a bit like believing that God put fossils into the rocks in order to mislead Darwin about the evolution of life. These dualities show that the five superstring theories all describe the same physics, and that they're also physically equivalent to supergravity. One cannot say that superstrings are more fundamental than supergravity, or vice versa. Rather, they are different expressions of the same underlying theory, each useful for calculations in different kinds of situations. Because string theories don't have any infinities, they're good for calculating what happens when a few high-energy particles collide and scatter off each other. However, they are not of much use for describing how the energy of a very large number of particles curves the universe or forms a bound state, like a black hole. For these situations, one needs supergravity, which is basically Einstein's theory of curved spacetime with some extra kinds of matter. It is this picture that I shall mainly use in what follows. To describe how quantum theory shapes time and space, it's helpful to introduce the idea of imaginary time. Imaginary time sounds like something from science fiction, but it's a well-defined mathematical concept. Time measured in what are called imaginary numbers. One can think of ordinary real numbers such as 1, 2, negative 3, 0.5, and so on, as corresponding to positions on a line stretching from left to right. 0 in the middle, positive real numbers on the right, and negative real numbers on the left. Imaginary numbers can then be represented as corresponding to positions on a vertical line. 0 is again in the middle, positive imaginary numbers plotted upward, and negative imaginary numbers plotted downward. Thus, imaginary numbers can be thought of as a new kind of number at right angles to ordinary real numbers. Because they are a mathematical construct, they don't need a physical realization. One can't have an imaginary number of oranges or an imaginary credit card bill. One might think this means that imaginary numbers are just a mathematical game, having nothing to do with the real world. From the viewpoint of positivist philosophy, however, one cannot determine what is real. All one can do is find which mathematical models describe the universe we live in. It turns out that a mathematical model involving imaginary time predicts not only effects we have already observed, but also effects we've not been able to measure, yet nevertheless believe in for other reasons. So, what is real and what is imaginary? Is the distinction just in our minds? Einstein's classical, that is, non-quantum, general theory of relativity combined real time and the three dimensions of space into a four-dimensional space-time. But the real-time direction was distinguished from the three spatial directions. The world line, or history of an observer, always increased in the real-time direction, that is, time always moved from past to future. But it could increase or decrease in any of the three spatial directions. In other words, one could reverse direction in space, but not in time. On the other hand, because imaginary time is at right angles to real time, it behaves like a fourth spatial direction. It can therefore have a much richer range of possibilities than the railroad track of ordinary real time, which can only have a beginning or an end, or go around in circles. It is in this imaginary sense that time has a shape. To see some of the possibilities, consider an imaginary time-space-time that is a sphere, like the surface of the Earth. Suppose that imaginary time was degrees of latitude. Then, the history of the universe in imaginary time would begin at the South Pole. It would make no sense to ask what happened before the beginning. Such times are simply not defined, any more than there are points south of the South Pole. The South Pole is a perfectly regular point of the Earth's surface, and the same laws hold there as at other points. This suggests that the beginning of the universe in imaginary time can be a regular point of space-time, and that the same laws can hold at the beginning as in the rest of the universe. The quantum origin and evolution of the universe will be discussed in the next chapter. Another possible behavior is illustrated by taking imaginary time to be degrees of longitude on the Earth. All the lines of longitude meet at the north and south poles. Thus, time stands still there, in the sense that an increase of imaginary time, or of degrees of longitude, leaves one in the same spot. This is very similar to the way that ordinary time appears to stand still on the horizon of a black hole. We've come to recognize that this standing still of real and imaginary time, either both stand still or neither does, means that the space-time has a temperature, as I discovered for black holes. Not only does a black hole have a temperature, it also behaves as if it has a quantity called entropy. The entropy is a measure of the number of internal states, ways it could be configured on the inside, that the black hole could have without looking any different to an outside observer, who can only observe its mass, rotation, and charge. The black hole entropy is given by a very simple formula I discovered in 1974. It equals the area of the horizon of the black hole. There is one bit of information about the internal state of the black hole for each fundamental unit of area of the horizon. This shows that there is a deep connection between quantum gravity and thermodynamics, the science of heat, which includes the study of entropy. It also suggests that quantum gravity may exhibit what is called holography. Holography is essentially a phenomenon of interference of wave patterns. Holograms are created when the light from a single laser is split into two separate beams. One bounces off the object onto a photosensitized plate, the other passes through a lens and collides with the reflected light of the first beam, creating an interference pattern on the plate. When a laser is shone through the developed plate, a fully three-dimensional image of the original object appears. An observer can move around this holographic image, being able to see all the hidden faces that a normal photo couldn't show. The two-dimensional surface of the plate, unlike a normal photo, has the remarkable property that any tiny fragment of its surface contains all the information needed to reconstruct the whole image. Information about the quantum states in a region of space-time may be somehow coded on the boundary of the region, which has two dimensions less. This is like the way that a hologram carries a three-dimensional image on a two-dimensional surface. If quantum gravity incorporates the holographic principle, it may mean that we can keep track of what is inside black holes. This is essential if we are to be able to predict the radiation that comes out of black holes. If we can't do that, we won't be able to predict the future as fully as we thought. This is discussed in Chapter 4. In Chapter 5, I consider the question of whether the past is fixed or whether it can be changed by someone warping space-time so much that he or she can travel back in time. However, it seems there may be a chronology protection principle that prevents such warping and makes the universe safe for historians. The holographic principle. The realization that the surface area of the horizon surrounding a black hole measures the black hole's entropy has led people to advocate that the maximum entropy of any closed region of space can never exceed a quarter of the area of the circumscribing surface. Since entropy is nothing more than a measure of the total information contained in a system, this suggests that the information associated with all phenomena in the three-dimensional world can be stored on its two-dimensional boundary, like a holographic image. In a certain sense, the world would be two-dimensional.